the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to journey number 154 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring Elsie at 30,000 Feet by Tim Pratt. I am your guide in this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from Base Camp in the Treasure Valley. Hey there, everybody. I'm here again for another journey. We are not doing Edgar Allan Poe month anymore, unfortunately, but we'll try to get a couple things lined up for next year for that. I had a lot of fun with that, but I have another story for you here today, another journey for us to go on. This journey comes to us from Tim Pratt. And if you don't know who Tim Pratt is, where have you been for a while? Tim Pratt is an author that I've followed for many years, featured prominently on Escape Pod and podcasts, all of the Escape Artists podcasts, and that's where I first was introduced to Tim Pratt with his story, Impossible Dreams, I believe. I actually kind of worked with Tim. One of the stories that I really loved from Tim Pratt, I read in the Intergalactic Medicine Show magazine, which isn't around anymore, unfortunately. But it was called The Dream Engine. And I just loved that story and thought it was one of his best and just a favorite story of mine. And so one of my goals when I first started this podcast was to do that story, to do Dream Engine. And so I think I did. I think it's like journey number 20 and 21 because I split it into two episodes. And I'll put links to those in the show notes. But then I didn't realize at the time that he had written a whole novel, a young adult novel, about the same characters from The Dream Engine in a story called The Nex, a novel called The Nex. And so once I found that out, I was pretty excited about it and asked him if I could produce an audiobook, a full cast audiobook for him. And he said, yeah, that'd be great. Go ahead and do it. And so I put a cast together and Rich Outfield. Whoa, what was that? Rish Outfield. Oh, right. I talked on my Patreon feed that I wanted a sound effect for whenever I mention Rish on the show. Okay, I like it. Rish Outfield, who you'll hear from after this episode, invite him to come talk about this again. He was in there, and I had Renee Chambliss do a lot of the work, and Abigail Hilton, and Dave Robison, and just a lot of people got a lot of help for that. I'll put a link to that also on Audible if you're interested in the next. I've tinkered with the idea of doing a trailer for that, but it's a lot of work, so I haven't done that yet, but I probably should. I should try to promote myself more. But anyway, that's a lot of talking. But you're here to listen to a new Tim Pratt story. And when I say new, this is like only 2 months old. I started following Tim Pratt on his Patreon. And if you follow, even at the $1 level, if you follow Tim Pratt on patreon.com/Tim Pratt, he puts out a story every month for all of his subscribers. And I don't know what tier it is, but he does two stories actually, and you get two stories if you donate at a higher level. and you have access to all of his past stories that he's put on Patreon. And I read a few of those, and I always figured one day I'll stumble upon another Tim Pratt story that I want to produce for the podcast. And when I saw this one come across about 2 months ago, LC at 30,000 feet, I instantly wanted to read it, and so I did. And I read the story, and I loved it, and I emailed him right away and said, can I produce this story for the podcast? And kind of told him my ideas for it, and he said, yeah, that'd be great. So here we go, here we are. And I think you'll recognize some of the voices here as well. But I'll talk about that after the story. And I've spent way too long up front here, so let's just get to the story. And I'll talk to you later with Rish Outfield. But first, real quick, a little bit more about Tim Pratt. Tim typically writes about love, monsters, secret societies, romance, trickster gods, terrible decisions, punching, metaphysics, nostalgia, entropy, magical anthropophagous cars, bridges to impossible realities, libraries, demonic thrift shops, cryptids, and breakfast foods, among other subjects. Most of his stories involve magic or science, or science that could be mistaken for magic. And he's pretty good at this stuff. He won a Hugo Award for one of his stories a while back, and his short story work have been nominated for the World Fantasy, Nebula, Sturgeon, and Stoker Awards as well. His stories have appeared in The Best American Short Stories, fancy, The Year's Best Fantasy, The Year's Best Fantasy and Horror, The Mammoth Book of Best New Horror, and, well, you get the idea. Go to timpratt.org to learn more about his books and collections. Or, like I mentioned earlier, head on over to patreon.org/timpratt, all one word, Tim Pratt, to read more of his stories. In fact, recently, in light of the coronavirus and all the quarantines, Tim made the first year of stories on Patreon free for anybody to read. That's pretty cool, but you might as well toss him a buck a month to read all of his other stories. All right, so come with me, and let's journey up to 30,000 feet.
Elsie at 30,000 Feet by Tim Pratt. I carefully stowed my lemon-yellow carry-on in the overhead compartment above my row, thinking of its precious cargo. I slid into my window seat and looked out at the checked bags conveyor belting into the belly of the plane. And I was content, even though my knees were pressed against the seat in front of me in the cramped confines of economy class. The flight was 2/3 empty, and almost everyone traveling alone had a whole row to themselves. I was looking forward to the infinite elbow room that passes for luxury back here in steerage. So, what kind of jerk rushes into the plane at the last minute, looks around, and takes the middle seat right next to mine? Even if that was her assigned seat, why not slide over to the aisle? The woman wasn't tall, but she took up a lot of space somehow, with jangling bracelets and dangling scarves and necklaces and masses of admittedly beautiful long red hair. She was middle-aged and slim and pretty, though her mouth seemed a little too wide, and when she grinned at me, there was bright red lipstick on her teeth, except her actual lips were unpainted, which was weird. She smelled like cardamom and cinnamon, and it would have been pleasant, except it was a lot.
I just love middle seats, don't you?
She trilled, shoving an immense handbag under the seat in front of her feet.
By the iron law of the skies, when you're in the middle seat, you get both armrests.
She planted her elbow and pushed my left arm off the divider in question. I didn't want to be rude, but then I thought, why not? She was. I put on my most icily polite customer service voice, full of subharmonic contempt, and said, "You could also have both armrests if you took the aisle seat."
"Yes, but then I couldn't take one away from you, and there's no thrill without conquest."
She extended a hand deep into my already compromised personal space and said,
"I'm Elsie."
Her fingernails were red and wet-looking. I took her hand briefly. It was dry and hot, and I thought of desert lizards. "Gustavo."
"Lovely to meet you, Dave. We're going to be best friends."
I almost corrected her. "How do you get Dave out of Gustavo?" But decided I didn't care. This was a short commuter flight. Not that I was commuting. In 2 hours I'd land, then take a train for another hour, and then I'd walk into Ma's house and show her what I'd brought, and watch her light up like a sunrise. I could survive a weird seatmate for that long. Elsie seemed content to ignore me for a bit after that. She had a big book of Sudoku puzzles, but she kept gnawing on the end of a pen and muttering random things to herself.
"A 7-letter word for chaos. Too easy. This desert-dwelling canid appears in mythology as a trickster figure. 6 letters. Is this puzzle for children?"
And I noticed she was filling in the Sudoku spaces with letters, not numbers. She didn't look up as the attendants did their safety demonstration and made sure we were all belted in, or when we taxied, or when we took off. I don't fly a lot, but I always enjoy that rising sensation, like a giant's hand pressing you back against your seat at first, but then the hand turns and lifts you up into the sky instead. I watched the landscape shrink beneath us, my favorite part. It's good to have perspective. When we leveled off at our cruising altitude, she shoved her puzzle book in the seat pocket and turned her whole body toward me.
"Tell me about yourself, Dave."
I shrugged and looked down at my phone, opening up a game where you matched different colored skulls into rows and made them flash and disappear. "Nothing to tell."
"Are you flying away from home, or towards home, or off on an adventure?"
I sighed pointedly and said, "Going home," without looking up from my phone.
"What took you to the rainy slope of the Pacific Northwest?"
I was going to blow her off, but I glanced up, and she seemed so deeply, genuinely interested, hanging on my every word, eyes bright and lively. Plus, it was actually a cool story, and I hadn't told anyone, because all my friends and relatives knew my ma, and information had a way of spreading around the gossip circle, and I wanted this to be a real surprise. Everyone thought I'd gone up to Seattle for a conference on hotel management, which was true, but only part of the truth. "You really want to know?"
"Desperately."
I couldn't help but smile. When my mother was little, she lived in Mexico with her parents, and they were pretty poor. The one thing they had that was special and precious was this silver cup with intricate filigree designs all over it that had been in the family for generations. They kept it up on a shelf, and my grandmother dusted it every day, and my grandfather only sipped from it on special occasions. When my mother turned 16, he let her sip a little wine from it, and she said it tasted better than anything ever before or since. I sighed. Later that year, the family fell on even harder times and decided they had to leave for the States. To get the money for the trip, they sold almost everything, including the cup. My mother remembered who they sold it to, the son of the richest man in town, who had so much silver he didn't even need it, and who once pinched her ass after church when no one was looking.
"Fascinating,"
she said, and it sounded like she meant it. I grew up hearing about that cup, and it was like a metaphor or a symbol or whatever for everything the family had lost and everything my mother wanted to get back. The reason she worked so hard, first cleaning houses and then managing other cleaners, the reason she pushed me to go to college so I could manage a hotel instead of just doing the laundry in one, and then someday maybe my kids would own the hotel, you know? We're working for the Silver Cup, she'd say. Anyway, I got on the internet one day and looked up that rich man and found out he'd died just a couple of years before and had no children, so there'd been an estate sale. There was a photo from the auction, and there was the Silver Cup, right on a table with a bunch of other silver getting sold off. I made some calls, and then a lot more calls, and eventually tracked down the cup. I was thinking I'd have to go to Mexico, but some antique dealer up in Seattle was the one who bought it, and he still had it for sale. I sighed. For a lot. He said it was pre-Columbian, which I don't believe for a minute, and he hadn't gotten it authenticated or anything, just said, I have learned to trust my instinct, if you believe that. I was afraid if I argued too much, he wouldn't sell it to me, though, so I bought it. All on a credit card, it'll take me years to pay down. But it doesn't matter, because when Ma sees it, I grinned, she's finally going to have the Silver Cup.
What a beautiful story. What a good son you are.
Elsie shook her head.
It's a shame she'll never get the cup. Maybe they'll find it in the wreckage.
She took the puzzle book out again and opened it on her lap. She'd sounded so matter-of-fact, saying something so awful. What are you talking about? She didn't look up, just tapped her pen on the page.
Are you a nervous flyer, Dave? You should be. This plane is going down.
My chest tightened up. Why would you say something like that?
Maybe I'm a psychic. Don't I look like I could be a psychic?
With the bracelets and scarves and all, she certainly looked like the kind of white lady who believes she's psychic. But I didn't say anything.
Maybe like your antique dealer. I've just learned to trust my instincts.
So you just have a bad feeling?
I didn't say that. And it wouldn't be that bad of a feeling anyway. To be perfectly honest, Dave, I'm going to make the plane crash. I think in about 20 minutes. We'll hit a mountainside if I time it right. That will be very inconvenient for the recovery crews, which is always fun. Oh, you look so stricken. If you tell anyone my plan, I'll deny it. How could someone like me bring a plane down anyway?
I wasn't afraid of flying. I knew the statistics on safety, and air travel always felt more miraculous than scary in practice. I was a little afraid now, but not because I was worried about crashing. It had never occurred to me before, really, that there was no way out on a plane. No getting away from my fellow passengers, no way of getting away from Elsie. If I made a fuss, or shouted, or told anyone what she'd said, she'd just deny it. And I'd be the one the flight attendants would approach with tight mouths and stern admonishments. I'd seen a guy have a panic attack on a flight once, and the only concern the crew had was to contain the disturbance. "Could you let me by?" I said, as friendly as possible. "I have to go to the bathroom."
"Certainly. You wouldn't want to piss yourself with fear when the plane starts to nosedive."
She slid out into the aisle and made an "after you" gesture. I went to the lavatory, splashed cold water on my face, stared at my face in the mirror for a minute, and came back out. I planned to sit in one of the many empty aisle seats and ignore the crazy lady until we landed. I didn't think she was a threat, not in the way she claimed, but I didn't want to be near her. Except, when I came down the aisle, I saw her in my window seat, with the silver cup in her hands. I raced forward, ducked into the row, snatched the cup out of her hands, and glared at her. "You went through my bag?"
"The cup just fell out. Contents sometimes shift during flight. Didn't you listen to the safety lecture?"
She patted the seat beside her.
"Sit. I'm an expert in ancient artifacts, and amazingly, that cup is pre-Columbian. probably from Peru, around 900 AD, if I had to guess. No idea how it ended up in Mexico, though it had plenty of time to get up there. It's not filigree, either, you Philistine. The technique is called repoussé. They took a sheet of silver and hammered and pressed the metal from the inside to make the raised designs on the outside. Look here. There's a serpent and a river. These are gardens. This is a temple. That's some kind of hunter. See the bow? I think it's a mythological story, though I'm not sure which one. I like the serpent, though. I've decided the serpent is the hero of the story.
I was still pissed she'd taken the cup, but she sounded like she knew what she was talking about, and I turned it around carefully in my hands. This thing was over 1,000 years old. That had to be bullshit, right? Maybe I'd take it to a museum or a university and see what they said.
I like you, Dave. You're a good boy. So instead of just crashing the plane, we're going to play a little game instead. To make things interesting. I love interesting things.
I shook my head. Lady, I don't know if you think you're funny or what, but talking about crashing a plane is no joke. If the crew hears you, you'll be arrested.
I'm not joking. Except in the grander sense that life is a joke. Well, your life, anyway. That's the general you. All people, not you specifically, though I do include you specifically under people.
So what? You have a bomb or something? I pitched my voice low.
Not at all. I just have a talent for tilting order towards chaos. Planes are complex systems, and complex systems are my favorite because they have so many failure points. Watch.
She snapped her fingers, and suddenly all the lights flickered and went out. The subtle roar of airflow and engines ceased, and the front of the plane tipped down sharply. In the dimness, illuminated only by the light through the windows, Elsie's eyes were somehow still bright. She snapped her fingers again, and the lights came back, and the plane leveled out. People were gabbling all around us, but I just stared at Elsie, and she stared back.
This is your captain speaking. Nothing to worry about, folks. Just a little glitch, but we have it under control, and we anticipate no further problems. Please relax and enjoy your flight.
Elsie snorted.
He has no idea what just happened and is desperately praying it won't happen again. And if he didn't just shit himself, he's got bowels of adamant. It's a shame praying won't help. Nothing can. Except you.
What do you mean? What can I do? All at once, I believed her. I believed she could bring down this plane with a snap of her fingers. I didn't know how, but I didn't doubt her. I squeezed the silver cup so hard I thought I'd crumple it. Elsie just gazed out the window, though.
I never understood why the gremlin in that old story hung around outside the plane.
She turned and looked at me, one eyebrow raised.
You know, the story about the monster on the wing and the passenger who freaks out. They made it into an episode of that old black and white TV show with the host with the cigarettes and the eyebrows. And then they remade it in color with Dr. Lizardo as the passenger. And then they did another remake that didn't even have a monster, so what's the point?
She looked back out the window.
Brr! You couldn't pay me to ride around out there on the wing. It's so much nicer inside. Look, you get free pretzels.
She shook the packet at me. I'd missed the snacks while I was in the bathroom, apparently. That did not strike me as my biggest problem. You said I could stop the plane crash. Elsie put a hand to her chest and looked aghast.
I did not say that. Although you can. Except you won't. What I said was, instead of just crashing the plane, we'll play a game. It's a better offer than Dr. Lizardo got. So, you get to choose. I can crash the plane and let everyone aboard die, but spare your life. Or, I can just kill you and let the plane land safely. It's a classic morality thought experiment. except it's not an experiment, and you don't have much time to think about it.
Why are you doing this? I said. None of this has to happen.
Plane rides are boring, Dave. I hate being bored. This is interesting. And it's a great chance to get to know my fellow passengers. What kind of fun can I have with a plane besides crashing it? I guess I could try to send us through some sort of technicolor rift in space-time, maybe to a mysterious land full of dinosaurs.
She paused and seemed to consider, then shook her head.
No, never mind. Where would I even source the dinosaurs? A crash is simpler and more elegant.
Is this some kind of test? I said. Like, you're testing me to see if I'm a good person or not.
What an idea. Nothing's either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. That's from the Bible. Or Milton, or something. Usually, no, it's not a test. That's kind of my thing. Making people understand the deep truth of reality. Stuff just happens. But this time, just this once. Why not? Sure, it's a test.
She popped a pretzel in her mouth. I swallowed. How many people are on this plane?
72, not counting the crew. The thing seats 175, so they're probably losing money on this run. Not as much as they'll lose when the plane goes boom, though.
I was just killing time at that point, putting off the inevitable. When you say you'll spare me, what do you mean? How would you save me from a plane crash? She put her hand on my knee. The bottom dropped out of my stomach and my mind, and I was standing on a cold mountaintop. She put her finger under my chin and lifted my head, and far, far above, I saw a plane moving.
Like so. I'd put you down closer to civilization, though. I'm not a monster.
She paused.
Okay, from some points of view, I am a monster, but not that kind. Not today.
She bent down, picked up a rock, and dropped it into the silver cup I was still holding. Another touch, another lurch, and we were back in our seats. I looked into the cup, and the rock was still there. What are you?
I'm Elsie. I'm myself. Just as hard as I can be. I can do stuff, so I do. Don't beat yourself up looking for explanations.
Then, why me?
Why not? Time is ticking, Dave. Crash or no crash.
I bowed my head. I held the cup tightly in my hands. Ma would be okay. She had my sisters and the cousins and all. I'd been seeing a guy who worked at the bakery a little bit, but nothing too deep. He'd be sad, not destroyed. I wasn't a brain surgeon or something. Nobody would die at the hotel if I didn't show up for work next week. Kill me, I said. Save them.
What? Are you serious? You don't even know these people, and you die for them?
She pointed at a woman sitting in the row across from us, just jabbing her finger openly, without even trying to be subtle.
Like her. She's cheating on her boyfriend. She's also cheating on her girlfriend, who doesn't know about the boyfriend. She's a double cheat. You're going to give up your life for her.
I frowned. How do you know any of that? Can you read minds?
Where would be the fun in that? Then no one would ever surprise me. No, you don't need telepathy when you can eavesdrop on phone conversations and peek at text messages in the boarding area. My point is, she's shit. And you die for her. Explain that to me.
I had the feeling she wouldn't get it. That maybe she couldn't get it. But I tried. So the thing is, I'm never going to cure cancer.
Heaven forfend,
she murmured. I'm too out of shape to run into a burning building to rescue anybody. I do my best. I try to live a good life. I try not to cause anyone harm. But that's it. I'm going to die sometime. Everybody does.
Speak for yourself,
she muttered. If I die here, now, and it saves all these people, that's more meaningful than I would have ever expected my death to be. I was desperately hoping this was a test, that Elsie was maybe an angel in disguise. I only went to church when Ma insisted I join her for Mass, but that early training was in me deep. That I just had to prove my willingness to sacrifice. But the thing was, if it was a test, I had to be genuinely willing. And to my surprise, I was. Do I like it? I said. No. Would I like to stay around and enjoy the parade they'd throw in my honor if they knew I'd saved everybody? Of course I would. But with the choice you've given me, there isn't really any choice at all. 72 people, plus the crew. The math wasn't even hard.
This is how I'd kill you.
And I was falling, the wind whipping into my eyes so hard I had to squeeze them shut. At least then I couldn't see the brown and white mountains below rushing up at me. My body was terrified and clenched, but I just forced myself to relax and spread out my arms and legs. The impact would kill me so fast it wouldn't even hurt, right? That was something. I held the silver cup close to my chest. My one regret was that Ma wouldn't get to see it. I thumped back into my seat and looked at Elsie through my tear-blurred vision. She smirked.
So? Last chance. What's your call?
I laughed. I laughed right in her face. And for the first time, she looked surprised. And I loved it. You think that changes anything? Of course that doesn't change anything. Your mama might have raised a mass murderer, Elsie, but mine didn't. She flung herself back in her seat and crossed her arms over her chest and said,
Ugh, I had to pick the one pure of heart person on this stupid plane.
I bet I'm not the only one, I said. I bet most people would do exactly what I'm doing.
We'll see, Gus. We'll see.
So you did know my... I wasn't on the plane anymore. I was sitting by the gate back in Seattle. I looked around, bewildered. And there was Elsie, in a chair a few rows away, sitting next to that blonde double cheat. She caught my eye, winked, and then pressed a finger to her lips. Shh. I stood up and went to the desk, pulling my carry-on along after me, my mind whirling. Excuse me, I said to the woman behind the computer. I need to report. She held up a just a moment finger and said over the public address,
Passenger Gustavo Reyes, please come to the desk.
That's me, I said. She looked at me, frowned and said,
There's a problem with your ticket. I'm afraid you'll have to leave the secure area immediately.
What do you mean?
There's a problem with your ticket.
Something was strange about her eyes. They were a little glazed, a little far away.
I'm afraid you'll have to leave the secure area immediately. If you do not go willingly, we'll call security.
I turned and pointed to Elsie. That woman. She picked up a phone.
Security needed at gate A10.
I stepped back, holding up my hands. Okay, I'm going. I pulled my bag after me and walked toward Elsie, who rose smoothly to meet me.
Say hello to your ma for me, Gus. I'm sure she'll love the cup.
I don't know what you're doing, but... She patted my cheek.
I bet you do, though. I'm trying again with someone less scrupulous. You'd better hurry and get to your rental car.
I don't have... My phone buzzed. A text from a rental company in the airport telling me a reservation I'd never made was ready. It's like a 12-hour drive.
True, but if you fall out of a car, you won't hurt yourself too badly.
Please, don't do this, I said.
It's not up to me.
She nodded toward the blonde, who was furiously texting.
It's up to her this time. Go, Gus, before I'm taken by another whim. I did give you a little reward, though, for being such a good boy. Drink up. You'll like the taste.
I hesitated. But what could I do? Tackle her? What would that achieve besides getting me arrested and possibly teleported to fall from a very great height? I'd done all I could. On the shuttle to the rental car pickup, I opened my carry-on and removed the silver cup. When I held it in my hands, the filigree... No, wait. Repoussé patterns seemed to move. The river flowing. The hunter stalking. The serpent slithering. If I looked at them directly, the designs were still, but they moved on the edges of my vision. I wondered what would happen if I drank out of it. I wondered if I'd be brave enough to find out. Once I got into my car and mapped out the route home on my phone, I tuned the radio to the news. Either Elsie was right about people, or I was. I listened and waited to find out which one it would be.
The cast of characters for this story were, of course, Rish Outfield as Gustavo, Abigail Hilton as Elsie, Bria Burton as the airport gate agent, and I, lovable, furry old Marshall, as the airplane captain. So there you go. There's Elsie at 30,000 Feet by Tim Pratt. I hope you enjoyed that story as much as I did. I really enjoyed it, and I knew Rish Outfield would as well. That's why I invited him to be the narrator for it, and it's why I invited him here to talk about it with me afterwards. Hey, Rish, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. On more than one level, thanks for having me on your show. But boy, more than that, when you sent me this story, I was so grateful that you thought of me to narrate it. I loved it. Oh my gosh. You mentioned a few minutes ago Impossible Dreams. And that's the first Tim Pratt story that I remember hearing over on Escape Pod. And Big Anklevich and I talk endlessly about Impossible Dreams. That it captured our imagination because we were movie people, and everybody had heard these, you know, stories of movies that almost happened, or the way this is that movies almost happened and they didn't. And it was a beautiful story. I loved it. And I've read some other Tim Pratt stuff over the years. I've participated, I think, on your episodes with Tim Pratt stories. But Elsie at 30,000 Feet was the first one where I was just like, oh my gosh, I love this as much as I loved Impossible Dreams. I was so honored to be able to narrate it. And now, yeah, I guess the version you just played is not just me, but you know how I do the audiobooks that I do. I do all the voices. So I did the whole story, and you could just swap out Elsie's lines and the captain's lines here or there. But
yes,
but I just went through the whole darn thing, and so I felt like, you know, it was me getting to do this story. And I emailed Tim. I don't know if that's allowed, but I did it. And I asked him, I said, dude, I just read this story for Journey Into, and I loved it so much. And I just kept thinking about The Twilight Zone. I thought about Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. And I thought about, gosh, what's the one where they go back in time and they look out the window of the plane and there are dinosaurs down there.
I know the episode, but I can't think of the title of it. But yeah, that's referenced in the story as well.
And yeah, I asked him, well, was this story meant to be your tribute to the Twilight Zone? And he was just like, yeah, it's obvious, right? With the references, he's a big fan of the Twilight Zone, and this was him giving it a nod. But I feel like I'm talking and not letting you talk. But if you don't mind that,
well, let me ask you one thing. I mean, one of the big reasons I thought of you, I mean, we've talked about the Twilight Zone ourselves many times, and then you started doing a podcast with your niece about Twilight Zone, and you reviewed both the original William Shatner Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, and you've also talked about the excerpt from the movie with John Lithgow playing the role where he's in the airplane, and you've talked about both of those. And then it was like a couple weeks later when I read this story, I'm like, oh man, this is perfect for filling that gap in there. To me, it felt like perfect timing to have you read this story. And I think I rely on you too much for narration and stuff, and I need to do more of it myself, but I just couldn't let this go without letting you narrate it. So,
well, yeah, like I said, I'm honored. I don't know why you didn't do it yourself, because this story is so great. I wouldn't give it to anybody else if Tim had given me this story. But again, thank you. And I hope that I did it justice. And yeah, you did it in full cast. And so that will be super fun to listen to. Different from the experience that I had reading it. And yeah, the thing that I was going to say about the story itself, the thing that captured my imagination the most was the moment where Elsie gives him this sadistic choice, as they said in the Spider-Man movie in 2002. Mm. The option of dying, but all these people survive. Or being safe, but all these people die. And I don't know what it was, but anybody who listened to this story had to have experienced the same thing that I did, which was, what would I do? What would I say?
Right.
If given this choice? And I don't know, the fact that he is sort of able to thwart her by jumping on that grenade, by saying, no, I'll do it. I'll die so that these people can live. And she tries to talk him out of it. And she gives him logic. And she points out, you know, how nasty other people are on the plane. And it doesn't dissuade him. And I feel like you and I would do the exact same thing in his shoes. Even if she was just like, oh, that girl's cheating on her boyfriend. And that guy, you know, is embezzling money from his job and all that stuff. I hope that I can die in a noble way. I hope that I can live in a noble way enough to the point where I can say the world is better off because I was in it. And this character clearly has that opportunity. Most of us don't get that choice where it's just like, yes, I can die for something instead of living for nothing. And so, yeah, it's just, again, holy cow, it spoke to me. It was really cool to be able to live vicariously through this character.
Yeah, no, it was great. And it's interesting, this character of Elsie is a recurring character. He's written several different stories with this character. And I haven't read his Marla Mason series of books. It's kind of a magic user thing. Sorry, I haven't read it. But it started out as a character in that book, kind of a villain character for that hero. And he just fell in love with the character so much that he's written several short stories with her in it. And I've read a couple of those, and you know, who knows, they might pop up in the future. But this one, because of the homage to Twilight Zone, I had to do this one. So I thought Elsie was an interesting character. She's not just evil. She just kind of does whatever she wants to do kind of thing. And I thought it was kind of interesting how she wasn't happy with Gustavo's choice. And so she was going to try it again with somebody else. Maybe it'd be more fun for her. And it kind of left it open-ended. So I thought that was kind of neat. But I guess there's a reference in this story that I didn't get at first. Because Elsie's talking about, oh, well, you know, I would never want to be outside the plane like the gremlin was in that TV show, that black and white TV show. And then they redid it in color. And it says, and then they redid it again and there wasn't a monster. So what's the point? And I was like, what? I don't know what she's talking. I didn't know what Tim was talking about at that point. And it just a few weeks ago, I got CBS All Access, and I haven't watched hardly any of the Twilight Zone episodes on there, the new Twilight Zone ones. And so I had watched the first episode a long time ago when it was on YouTube for free, and thought it was pretty cool, kind of neat, but didn't know what the series would be like. So I started looking at the episodes, and I saw Nightmare at 30,000 Feet was the second episode of the Twilight Zone. And I was like, really? They redid it again? So I watched it, and I was really into it, at least, you know, the first half of the story. And I probably won't get into all the details of it, but I wanted you to watch it so we could talk about it as we talked about Tim Pratt's story. So I kind of got you to watch it. And I guess to spoil the ending of our review of that, I don't think either of us liked the ending of the story, but I don't know how much you liked the story to begin with of the new Twilight Zone.
Well, you just said you didn't want to go into it, but let's just go into it for a minute.
Okay.
There were two things that I didn't like about it, and everything else I thought was fine. And the two things that I didn't like were, like you said, the ending. And then two, that it was called Nightmare at 30,000 Feet, and they said it was based on the Richard Matheson short story and the episode of The Twilight Zone. Because it wasn't. It was an entirely new story. And I didn't like that they said that it was a remake of that. Why not just call it something else? Why pay the Matheson estate? I guess I understand that they wanted to cover themselves because it's a Twilight Zone episode that takes place in a plane, but it just, I didn't feel like they needed to. And because they were presenting it as yet another remake of that episode, it limited my enjoyment because I kept comparing and I kept waiting for the gremlin to show up and it didn't.
Yeah. And he even looked out the window a couple times and didn't see anything.
It wasn't about any of that stuff. And it was filled with homages. Like the captain is Captain Donner. And Richard Donner directed the original. And I felt like I just would have liked it better had it been called something else. And the people that say, oh, you know, this is kind of like the old Shatner episode, they would get something out of it. But the people that didn't know or didn't care, they could just enjoy it. But that's just me. I watched the new Twilight Zone, the 1980s revival. And almost every time they redid an old episode of the Twilight Zone, it was inferior. Because I think that they felt like times have changed in the 1980s. People don't have the patience for the kind of storytelling that they did in the 50s and the 60s. So let's be way, way more bombastic, or let's be way more obvious. And then there was a 21st century revival in like 2001 on UPN.
Oh, really?
And anytime they remade an episode there, it was awful because even more, so it was like they were compensating even more than they were in the 80s, where it's just like, well, okay, it's the 21st century now. And so no young person is going to sit still for a Twilight Zone episode the way that they used to be told. And then they did try it with Eye of the Beholder. They did Eye of the Beholder in almost the exact same way. They tried to make it look like it was one take, like Rope.
Oh, okay.
1917. But they used the exact same script and the exact same pacing and all of that stuff. And it just fell flat. It didn't work. Partly because they got the model. I think it was Molly Sims was the model that was under the bandages. They got her to do the narration. And when you hear somebody that talks like this, you're prepared for what she's going to look like under the bandages. Whereas in the 1960s one, they had like an old woman who had smoked her whole life doing the voiceover. And so when Donna Douglas is revealed under the wrapping, you were not prepared at all because it was the voice, no offense, of an ugly person. And so when everybody is so shocked and she's revealed to be gorgeous, it's like a triple slap to the audience. I love Eye of the Beholder. Spoilers, by the way, for a 60-year-old episode yes. of a TV show. But then here we are in 2019, 2020, and now we've got the new one. Is it okay to call it the Jordan Peele Twilight Zone?
I think so, yeah.
The episode that we're talking about was the first episode I had seen of the revival. And so like the profanity shocked me. I wasn't prepared for it. And then I went back and I watched the Camille Nanjiani episode, the comedian.
Oh, the comedian one. Yeah.
And I was just like, I felt like I was, I was 90 years old and it's like, this isn't how the Twilight Zone was. I didn't need the profanity. I didn't need the modernization. But anyway, sorry, I didn't like it. This episode is all about Adam Scott gets on this plane and he has had a mental breakdown. They explain. He talks to his wife in one scene. And she says something like, you know, you just have to be in the present. Don't dwell on the past. And he gets on this plane. He sits down in this seat and there is what is it? It's unlike any MP3 player I've ever seen.
Yeah.
If there was an MP3 player 20 years ago, it would have looked like that.
Yeah.
And it's this big blocky thing and somebody left it. And he turns it on and it's a podcast, presumably from the future, right? Did you get it from that it's from the future?
That's what, yeah. Yeah, he starts listening to it and it says, the details of flight 526 or whatever, flying, I can't remember where they were flying to Crete or something like that. It starts explaining the passengers and what happened before and there was some terrible tragedy, disaster that happened, and this is what led to it. And it starts going into all these details, and he starts looking around and seeing these things. And then it talks about and Captain Donner, and then the captain gets on the thing. Captain Donner here just wanted you to have a good flight and all these things. And so all these things that he's listening to on the podcast are happening around him, and he's realizing this is like real time. And I thought that part was kind of cool. Even though it was completely different, like you said, from the source material.
Right. Well, he will like stop the podcast and then he goes and he talks to somebody because he's suspicious or he's trying to alert them that something is not right. And he is not believed. Not only is he not believed, but I think everybody on the plane perceives him as a threat. First, as just like a crazy person. First as an overreacting person, second as a crazy person, and third as like somebody who is seriously dangerous.
Yeah, because he starts confronting other passengers and starts making a fuss for everybody. And then, of course, the stewardesses and the security has to get involved and the captain has to come back and yell at him and tell him to get back in his seat. And at that point, nobody trusts him.
And I felt sorry for him because, you know, we had the information that nobody else had. Only he knows what he's been hearing on this thing. And we know that he's innocent, but everybody else, you know, they think he's A, having a mental breakdown, or two, this guy is, you know, a terrorist or a crazy person or some kind of sicko. And I felt for him. Every time he sits down, he listens to more of this podcast and it gives him like more details of what happened to this mysterious plane that just disappeared. And eventually he listens long enough that his own name is mentioned as a famous person involved in this plane crash or this plane's disappearance. And I just, oh my gosh, I knew at some point in the episode that he was going to cause this plane to be lost or to crash. They never gave us any hint as to what happened to the plane or you know, how it was going to disappear and they would never find the plane. But I was just like, okay, somehow this guy is going to crash the plane. Oh no, don't do it. Do we give away the ending?
Why not? It's not very good. So
okay. So he's telling all these people and they won't listen to him. Eventually the sky marshal, I guess, handcuffs him or zip ties him or whatever. And this is a part that I also didn't dig. He says, if you'll just listen to this. And she says, I listened to it. It was very disturbing or something like that. But I was just like, wait a minute. If you actually listened to this, then you know that this guy isn't crazy. Then you know that these things that he's been listening to, it's more than a coincidence. It knows details that it couldn't know and all that. And I think that she probably just said that she patronized him. She's like, yes, I listened to it. But there is a guy on the plane who says that he believes him. And, you know, he's on his side and he's just like, I want to prevent this plane from going down as much as you do. You know, if there was only some way I could get into the cockpit. And on the podcast, sure enough, it tells how somebody could have gotten into the cockpit to take the plane down. And so he tells this guy this, and it was the wrong guy to tell.
Right.
So he goes in there and he crashes the plane. And history will prove that Adam Scott's character was to blame. This guy is a villain that crashed the plane. And so if the episode had just ended there, I would not be saying anything negative about it, except for I wish it hadn't been called that. But the episode doesn't end there. The episode ends with the plane smashed into the ocean in pieces, and he washes ashore, Adam Scott does, and he's all right. And not only is he all right, but his podcast device has washed ashore and it still works. And he notices a second podcast on there, a follow-up episode to their popular episode about Flight 1015. And he starts to listen to that. And it just, yeah, here's where it falls apart, dude. A, how is that possible?
Yeah, no, I'm with you all the way.
And they say, well, miraculously, eventually, months later, was it 2 months later, 6 months later? I don't know how many months later. Every single person on that flight is found alive on an atoll in the Atlantic somewhere. And everybody, that is, except for this guy. The famous guy that everybody says caused the plane to crash. And so he's just freaked out. And then he looks and he sees all the survivors from the plane. And they are walking toward him like something out of a George A. Romero movie.
Right.
And I guess what has happened is they all blame him for the plane crashing. And so, yay, let's all murder him together. And they do. And that's the end of the episode. Spoilers, once again. Retroactive spoilers. I don't know why I hated that so much, but I did. Because it didn't give us any answers of how they all could have survived. There was something supernatural that was going on. The podcast going back in time, that is supernatural. The things that the podcaster knew that it couldn't know. And then a second episode knowing things that it couldn't know. And the last shot of the episode is them tearing Adam Scott apart with their bare hands.
Right.
And then the camera moves and you see the plane just destroyed in the water. And yet everybody survived.
Yeah, I thought it was just too much, too far. My favorite gimmick in that was the podcast from the future. And it even kind of ruined that, I thought. You know, I mean, we know it's a Twilight Zone episode, so we know there's going to be something going on. But I just think that took it too far. And I kind of didn't care for the other guy. I mean, it was kind of interesting, I guess, that this guy that was on his side all the whole time was the one that was going to take the plane down. But even that, I thought, wasn't very creative, I guess. My anticipation was that it was going to be somehow this guy, this innocent guy, that he somehow brought down the plane, not that somebody else was going to take the information that he gave them and take the plane down. But somehow he was inadvertently trying to help, but would be the cause of the plane. That would have been a pretty interesting way to end the show. And that whole device of having the podcast would have been used pretty well. But then when you have it and him and everybody else survive the crash, and then they all kill him, everybody was in on it, right? It wasn't just the captain or the stewardess or the Russian guys, or it was everybody on the plane coming after him. And that just seemed pretty lame.
It's also super nihilistic. And you could get that in Rod Serling's show. There were many episodes, probably Time Enough at Last is the most nihilistic episode of The Twilight Zone, with the worst ending. But I feel like if I were one of those passengers and that we all miraculously survived this plane crash, murder would be the last thing on my mind. I'd be so happy that I was alive, that we were alive, that I could forgive this jagoff who made a spectacle of himself on the, you know what I mean? That everybody, every man, woman, and child on that island didn't ask, how did we end up on this island? They asked, how can we kill this guy? You made me watch it.
I did. I made you watch it. I thought it was interesting enough to watch and compare to the other ones. I guess I wasn't thinking of, it should have never been named that. But you're right, it shouldn't. They should have went with some, you know, flight 1015 or whatever the flight was or something like that.
Yeah, it's the Odyssey of Flight, whatever the number was. That's the episode of the dinosaur one. I'm not really mad at you for making me watch it, because it's interesting and it provided us with this conversation. But I do resent that about the episode, because up until the plane crashes, I was still waiting for something supernatural, whether it was a portal that opened up, whether there was a being on the plane that shouldn't be there, somebody from the future, somebody that's not human, a gremlin is inside one of the overhead compartments or whatever, you know what I mean? And it crashes the plane. The crazy terrorist guy who's upset with his wife, he pulls off his face mask and is a gremlin. You know, I was waiting for something supernatural. And it wasn't that, and then we get a supernatural ending, but it's unsatisfying.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that's, I don't know how much, if I'm going to watch the rest of the series or not. but I guess we'll see.
Well, if there were episodes that people all agree are really, really good, then maybe those are the ones to check out. In preparation for my podcast, which is called The Twilight Groan, that I do with my millennial niece, I searched out, like, what are considered the best episodes, the must-see episodes, because I figured with her attention span and with how social she is, although at this point where we're recording, nobody is social, we'll only be able to do like a dozen of these, or 10, or if I'm unlucky, 5 or 6. So which episodes are considered the most vital? And you can probably guess. Time Enough at Last. Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. It's a Good Life. The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. To Serve Man. The Invaders.
Yep, all good ones.
There are probably 2 or 3 that I'm not thinking of right now. But like, those are the ones that almost everybody agrees you've got to see.
Yeah. Yeah, my son actually in his... I guess it was his history class, watched The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street as a in his class, and I thought that was pretty cool that they were, because they were talking about communism and stuff like that, and so that was kind of neat that his school teacher brought up that episode for him to watch and think about it.
Well, yeah, I think that that's a first season episode from 1960, and it, except for like one or two lines of dialogue that just sound hokey to our ears now, it holds up completely. And you can totally understand the way that people feel, because people have not changed in those 60 yeah. years.
Yeah, I tried to talk to him about that. I tried to say, well, yeah, that was obviously pointing to communism at the time, but how does that apply today? Do you still see that kind of mentality? And I don't know. We didn't get into the discussion too much, but I was hoping to talk to him more about that, but.
Well, I had the conversation with my niece, and she said it was her favorite of the episodes that we watched.
Oh, okay.
And she
Spoiler
said...
Spoiler for the Twilight Groan.
Well, but that's okay. It was going to be the next episode that's released in March, but then we got a hold of a remake episode of an episode we'd already done, and so I bumped Maple Street till the next month.
Ah, okay.
But she said... You know, this reminds me of, you know, racism. This reminds me of don't trust somebody that doesn't look like you or doesn't believe what you believe or, you know, votes a different way than you or whatever thing makes us different rather than makes us the same. And I just loved that because that's exactly what it's saying, that these aliens, these beings will plant suspicion in our mind and then just take a step back and watch us destroy ourselves. And they say that it always works. They'll just go from town to town and do that until we've turned on ourselves. Because human nature is we point
suspicious.
Out how we're different rather than all the ways that we're similar, all the ways that we're the same. And it sucks. I hope that changes someday, but I don't know that it ever will.
Yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be timeless, that episode. It would be nice if it was quaint. Oh, remember the time when we were like that?
Well, she is from the next generation, and you've got kids that are from her generation. And I can't help but feel parentally toward her, even though she's not my child. And I hope that their generation is better than ours. In the same way that sometimes you'll look around and you'll say, our generation is better than the one that came before. In some ways.
Yeah.
I hope that continues. And that instead of saying, oh gosh, I sure wish it were like the good old days, the way a lot of people are, to look toward the future and say, someday we'll be above this. Someday it's going to be better than it is right now. I guess those are two ways of looking at the world, but I can't help but look at my niece's generation and her mentality and say, yeah. No, don't just sit back and let injustice go. You guys fight for what you know is right. And I guess that brings us back to Elsie and and this story, because she is genuinely shocked that Gustavo is willing to do this. And she tries to talk him out of it, and he won't. And she's just like, well, this was an aberration. This guy was an outlier. But you know what? She's going to find out that she is wrong. She's going to talk to the next person, and then she's going to talk to the next person. Eventually, I think she's not even going to crash the plane. She's just going to be like, I'm going to go...
Somewhere
I don't know.
Else.
I'm going to go on Melrose or something in Beverly Hills, and I'm going to find, you know, some truly nasty people, and I'm going to mess with them. Because these people, you know, there was something wrong with all the people on this plane.
yeah, I would hope that most, even this girl that's cheating on her boyfriend and girlfriend or whatever in the story, even though that's something that she's doing that's not right, hopefully when it comes down to 72 people being killed or herself, hopefully she would be selfless. Hopefully most all the passengers in there. Or I guess, you know, you could find somebody that says, yeah, as long as I'm safe, I don't care.
You'll always find somebody like that. There are bad eggs everywhere. But But I think Elsie is going to have to go through a bunch of people before she reaches one of those people. And hopefully she loses interest before.
That's kind of why I like the way he left that open-ended, because it's unsure, but we're hopeful, I guess. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that back around to the story at hand. And thanks for coming on here and talking again. Pretty soon, this is just going to become another Marshall and Risch show here.
It's possible that there are people that skip when they hear that I'm going to be on there. But I like when the two of us get together, because we go in directions we would never go by ourselves.
True, yeah, very much.
I think that that's fun. We play off of each other in unexpected ways, or at least unexpected to me. And so I'm grateful that you had me on the show, that you got me to do the story. And thanks, Tim, for writing the story. It was thoughtful and amusing and scary. Hopefully he digs the way that it came out.
Yeah, I hope so. So, well, thanks everybody for listening to the podcast. I'm working on more stuff as well, but
tell them how they can support you. If they've enjoyed what they listened to just now and they want more, if they're cooped up in their house in June of 2020 because people are still not going out, how can they help? We'll both be dead. I'm sorry. Okay. If it's March of 2020 and they're cooped up in their... Okay. Help me out here. How can they get more episodes?
Well, if you'd like to support me, you can always run over to patreon.com/journeyinto. And I do provide some extra content over there for your enjoyment. And all the episodes go up early on that podcast, or on the Patreon before it comes out on the main feed. And I try to get stuff out there for people to enjoy, as I do here, but I put a little bit of extra effort into doing stuff on Patreon, because those are the people that are willing to shell out $1 a month or something like that to support me. So head on over there if you'd like to support this podcast. It definitely provides fuel for my motivation to get more stuff out here and share more stuff with you. And if you have any comments or questions, you can go to journeyintopodcast@gmail.com and send me an email. And you can also call the voicemail line at 77JINTO107 and leave me a 3-minute voicemail. Or call me back and leave me more. But yeah, I'd love to hear from you. So I guess until next time, stay safe out there, everybody. Especially now during this virus. Take care of yourselves, stay safe, and journey on. The Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Which means that you can share this audio as much as you would like, but please do not try to sell it or change the audio. The theme music has been provided by Man in Space.